The smell hit her first. Copper and rot and something deeper, something that reminded her of wet soil after a lightning strike. Lyra pressed her face into the cavity of Theron's ribcage and breathed through her mouth, but even the air tasted like death. 3 days inside the carcass of a war beast. 3 days curled fetal between organs that had gone cold and stiff, her fingernails crusted with dried blood that was not her own, her lips cracked so badly that every swallow felt like swallowing glass. She did not know that somewhere beyond the scorched tree line, the Alpha King of the Northern Dominion had stopped mid-sentence during a war council, pressed his palm flat against his chest, and whispered a single word. Alive. But we need to go back a little. Not far. Just enough to understand how a girl ended up hollowing out a space inside the belly of a dead dire wolf the size of a draft horse and calling it shelter. Lyra had been the record keeper of the Ashenmoor pack. Not a warrior, not a healer, not a breeder. A record keeper. She catalogued grain stores, tracked moonrise cycles for shift rotations, and maintained the leather-bound ledgers that held every birth, death, and exile the pack had seen in 40 years. Her handwriting was precise. Her presence was not. She moved through the pack hall like a draft under a door. Something felt occasionally and never addressed. Her wolf had never surfaced. Not once. In a society where your wolf was your worth, where even the lowest Omega could at least shift and run and hunt small game, Lyra was a vacancy, a body with no beast inside it. The pack elder, a squat woman named Breeder, with tobacco-stained teeth and an impressive collection of grudges, had examined Lyra as a child and declared her hollow, Wolf Baron. The word followed Lyra like a scent mark she could not wash off. She was 23. She had never been touched with kindness by anyone still living. Her mother had died during the birth that brought Lyra into the world, and her father had walked into the Ashwood a year later and never returned. The pack took her in the way a body absorbs a splinter, with inflammation and slow rejection. She slept in the records room. Not because she was assigned to sleep there, but because the room had a lock on the inside and a coal stove that kept the ink from freezing, and after the third time she woke up with her hair cut to the scalp by pack juveniles who thought it was funny, she stopped sleeping anywhere that did not lock. The morning everything changed. Lyra was counting salt rations in the cellar. Her fingers were numb. The cellar smelled like brine and mildew and the sour ghosts of last autumn's fermented cabbage. She was on her knees, her worn dress pulling tight across shoulder blades that jutted like wing stubs, counting the ceramic jars one by one when the first explosion hit. The ceiling cracked. Dust and mortar rained down. Lyra threw her arms over her head and felt a chunk of stone strike her forearm, hard enough to send white light across her vision. Then the screaming started. She scrambled up the cellar stairs. The pack compound was on fire. War beasts. She had read about them in the old records, but had never seen one. Enormous, dire wolves bred for battle. Each one bonded to a rider, their pelts thick as boar hide, and their jaws capable of sapping a man's femur like a birch twig. 3 of them were touring through the eastern wall of the compound, their riders armored in black leather, etched with silver runes that caught the firelight and threw it back in blinding arcs. The raid was over in 12 minutes. Lyra counted, because counting was what she did. 12 minutes from the first explosion to the last scream. The Ashenmoor pack's warriors fought and fell. Their alpha, a man named Garrett, who had once looked directly through Lyra while she was handing him a census report, shifted into his grey wolf, and launched himself at the largest war beast. The beast caught him mid-leap. The sound his spine made was something Lyra would hear in her sleep for the rest of her life, a sound like a green branch twisted past its limit. Then the riders were gone. Fast as they came, they took the grain stores, the weapons cache, and 7 of the youngest wolves as conscripts for some war. Lyra had only read about in dispatches she was not supposed to read. They left the dead and the burning. And they left one war beast. It lay on its side near the shattered eastern wall, an arrow thick as a broom handle buried in its throat. It was enormous even in death, its black pelt matted with blood and ash, its jaws still slightly open to show canines as long as Lyra's hand. The beast's rider was pinned beneath it, already dead, his neck bent at an angle that necks do not go. The surviving pack members gathered in the courtyard, 11 out of 46. Breeder was among them, her left arm hanging wrong, but her voice still sharp as a filed blade. It was Breeder who pointed at Lyra. "This happened because of you," Breeder said, her good arm trembling, her eyes red-rimmed and ancient with fury. "The hollow girl, the wolf baron. You brought this curse on us. Your mother was cursed, and she passed it to you, and now look. Look at what you have done." Lyra opened her mouth. No words came. She had learned years ago that defending herself only extended the beating. A younger wolf named Senna stepped forward. Senna had once shared a bread roll with Lyra during a winter when rations were thin, splitting it precisely in half without being asked. But now Senna's mate was dead in the rubble, and grief makes strangers of everyone. "Get out," Senna said. Her voice was not cruel. It was exhausted. "Just go, Lyra, please, before someone does something worse than talking." There was a long silence. Lyra looked at the 11 faces. She searched for one that held something other than blame or indifference. She did not find it. Senna would not meet her eyes. So Lyra walked to the records room. She took her mother's wedding ring from the box under the floorboard, a thin silver band worn smooth as river stone. She took the heavy wool cloak that was the only good thing she owned. She took the small knife she used to trim candle wicks. She walked out through the shattered wall and into the ashwood. She walked for 2 days. She ate nothing because there was nothing to eat. The forest floor in late autumn was a graveyard of brown needles and frozen mud. She found water once, a thin stream that tasted of iron and leaf rot, and she drank until her stomach cramped, and then she drank more. On the second night, the temperature dropped hard. Her breath crystallized in front of her face. The wool cloak was not enough. She shook so violently that her teeth cut the inside of her cheek, and she tasted blood, warm and copper bright. And for a terrible moment, that warmth was the best thing she had felt in days. That was when she found the war beast. It had not been the one at the compound. This was another, fallen farther along what must have been the raider's retreat path. Larger than the first, its fur was the color of deep water at midnight, and even in death it held a strange dignity, its massive head resting on its four paws like a sleeping dog dreaming of rabbits. The arrow in its side had snapped off, leaving only the shaft stub protruding between two ribs. There was no rider nearby. Lyra stood over it in the dark. Her body had stopped shivering, which she knew from the records on hypothermia was a very bad sign. She was going to die out here. Not dramatically, not in battle. She was going to sit down against a tree and close her eyes, and that would be the whole story of Lyra, the wolf baron record keeper who froze to death 2 days from nowhere. Unless the carcass was still marginally warm. Not alive warm, but warmer than the air. The beast was large enough that the space between its foreleg and its belly formed a kind of cavity, and if she could push deeper, use the candle knife to open the hide, it took her 40 minutes. Her hands were so cold that the knife slipped twice, and she cut her palm, a shallow slice across the lifeline that bled sluggishly in the frigid air. But she opened a seam along the beast's underside and pushed herself in, pulling the heavy flap of fur and skin over her body like a blanket made of nightmares. Inside, the smell was overpowering. Blood. Organ meat going sour. Something musky underneath that was purely animal. A dense, wild scent like cedar bark and iron shavings and the ozone smell before a storm. She gagged, then breathed, then gagged again, then breathed. It was warm. She slept. When she woke, light was filtering through the beast's fur in thin amber lines. She was alive. Her hands ached with returning circulation, a fierce pins and needles that made her eyes water. She flexed her fingers one by one, counting them out of habit. All 10. She should have left. She knew that. But outside was the cold and the empty forest, and the nowhere that awaited her. Inside was warmth and something else she could not name, a feeling like standing in a doorway where the air changes temperature, a threshold sensation. She curled tighter. On the second day, she began to notice things. The carcass was not decaying the way it should. The blood had dried, but had not begun to blacken. The organs pressed against her back were cool and firm, not the soft collapse of decomposition. And there was a sound, so faint, she thought she was imagining it, for the first 6 hours. A rhythm. Slow. Impossibly slow. Like a heartbeat stretched across minutes instead of seconds. Thump. Then nothing. Then nothing. Then nothing. Then thump. She pressed her ear against the beast's interior wall. The sound vibrated through the bone and muscle and into her skull. It was not her own heartbeat. She checked. Hers was fast and thin and terrified. This one was deep and vast and ancient, like a drum at the bottom of a well. The war beast was not fully dead. Something in it was holding on. Not alive in any way that made biological sense, but connected to something, tethered to a force that kept the flesh from rotting and the blood from blackening, and the body temperature just barely above ambient. Lyra did not know what that meant. But she stayed. On the third day she heard the wolves, not the wild wolves of the Ashwood. These were different. She could hear the organized pattern of their movement through the frozen underbrush, the way they fanned out in a search line rather than clustering around prey. Riders. A hunting party. Lyra curled smaller inside the carcass. She pressed her hands over her mouth, the wool cloak bunched under her knees, her mother's ring dug into her finger where the band sat slightly too large. The wolves stopped. She heard shifting, the wet sound of bones restructuring and fur retreating into skin. Human footsteps. Several pairs. "This one," a male voice said. Deep. Clipped. The voice of someone accustomed to being obeyed immediately. Here. More footsteps. Someone kicked the war beast's haunch, and the impact traveled through the carcass and into Lara's spine. "It is Orin's beast," another voice said. Younger. Nervous. It must have come this far after the rider fell. Strange that it has not decomposed. "It has not decomposed," the first voice said, and there was something terrible in the patience of his tone, because something inside it is still a still. Silence. Lyra stopped breathing. "I can feel its heartbeat," the first voice continued. "I have felt it for 2 days. Faintly, like a thread pulled taut across a great distance. My wolf will not let me sleep. It paces. It howls. It claws at the inside of my chest. Your Majesty, the nervous voice began. Open it. The sound of a blade being drawn. Lyra's mind went white. She thought about screaming. She thought about praying. She thought about the fact that her candle knife was somewhere near her left hip, and that it would do absolutely nothing against a war party of the Northern Dominion. The hide split above her. Cold air rushed in. Daylight so bright after 3 days of amber gloom that her eyes clenched shut, and tears poured down her face without her permission. She felt hands, large hands. They gripped her upper arms and pulled her out of the carcass, like a midwife pulling a child from a womb, and the air hit her skin, and the light hit her eyes, and the smell of the open forest hit her nostrils so hard she thought she would be sick. She was on the ground, frozen pine needles pressing into her back, the wool cloak twisted around her waist. Blood and viscera from the carcass smeared across her dress, her arms, her neck, her face. Her hair, which had grown unevenly since the last time the pack juveniles had cut it, stuck to her cheeks in dark, matted clumps. She opened her eyes. He was enormous. That was the first coherent thought. Not just tall, though he was tall enough that his shadow covered her entirely, but wide, built like something designed for the sole purpose of surviving impact. His shoulders strained the seams of a black leather coat that bore the silver rune work of the Northern Dominion. His hair was dark as the war beast's pelt, cut short at the sides and longer on top, where it fell across a forehead marked by a scar that ran from his right temple to the bridge of his nose. His jaw was a hard line. His cheekbones could cut paper. But it was his eyes that stopped her. Golden. Not brown gold or hazel gold. Golden like the inside of a furnace. Golden like a coin held up to the sun. They caught the winter light and threw it back, and there was nothing in them that was human. Not in that first moment. His nostrils flared. Lyra watched something happen to his face. It was like watching stone crack. The hardness fractured for one instant. The jaw loosened. The lips parted. The terrible golden eyes widened by a fraction so small that only someone who spent their life cataloguing details would notice. He inhaled again. Deeper. His chest expanded. His wolf surfaced behind his eyes. She saw it. She had never had a wolf of her own, but she had spent 23 years surrounded by shifters, and she knew the look. It was the look of a beast rising from a deep place, ancient and vast, and utterly certain. "Mate," he said. The word fell between them like a stone dropped into still water. Lyra scrambled backward. Her shoulders hit the war beast's carcass. Pine needles and gore and the stink of 3 unwashed days. She was shaking. Not from cold this time.
"No,"
she whispered. "No, that is not. I am." "No," he crouched. Slowly. The way you crouch near a wounded animal. His leather coat pooled on the frozen ground. This close, she could smell him. Pine resin and wood smoke and something underneath. Something warm and dark and spiced like cinnamon bark left too long in a fire. Her body responded before her mind could catch up. Heat bloomed low in her stomach. Her pulse, already frantic, shifted rhythm, falling into a pattern she had never felt before. Falling into sync with something outside herself. The slow heartbeat. The one she had been listening to for 3 days inside the carcass. It was his. "You heard it," he said. "Not a question." She stared at him. Her lips trembling. Blood drying on her face. She must have looked insane. She must have looked like something dragged out of a nightmare. He reached forward and touched her face. One finger, the pad of his index finger, traced the line of her jaw, from the hinge below her ear to the point of her chin. The touch left fire in its wake, a warmth so sharp it almost hurt. "Who did this to you?" he said. His voice had changed. The command was still there, the bedrock authority. But layered over it now was something tight and dangerous, something that sounded like controlled fury. The scars on your arms, the marks on your wrists, the fact that you are starving. He paused. The fact that you are inside a dead beast because you had nowhere else to go. She could not answer. Her throat had closed. Something behind her sternum was cracking open, something she had kept locked in a room inside herself, and if she let it out now, she would not be able to put it back. She did the only thing she could think of. She lied. "I am no one," she said. Her voice was hoarse from 3 days of silence. "I am Wolf Baron. I have no pack. I have no name you would recognize. You are mistaken about the bond. It is not. I am not." He tilted his head. The scar across his face caught the light. "What is your name?" he said.
"Lyra."
"Lyra," he repeated. He said it the way some people say prayers, carefully, as if the syllables might break if handled wrong. "Lyra, I am Kael Voss, Alpha King of the Northern Dominion. I have waited 11 years for the mate bond to surface. My wolf has torn apart every dream I have had since I turned 18. I have fought 6 wars, buried 2 brothers, and held this kingdom together with my teeth and my stubbornness, and not once in 11 years has my wolf gone quiet." He leaned closer. She could see the gold of his eyes was not uniform. There were darker flecks in the iris, amber and copper, like sediment at the bottom of a river. "Until 2 days ago, when it stopped howling and started whimpering, like it had found something, like it was afraid that something would disappear before I could reach it." She was crying. She had not given herself permission to cry, but the tears were coming anyway, cutting clean tracks through the grime and blood on her face. "I cannot be what you need," she said. "I have no wolf. I am hollow." Something shifted in his expression. Not pity. She had seen pity before, and this was not that. It was closer to recognition. Like he was seeing something she could not. "You are not hollow," he said. "Whatever they told you, whoever told you that, they were wrong." He stood. He unclasped his leather coat and settled it around her shoulders. The coat weighed more than her wool cloak, and the lining was fur, real fur, body warm and impossibly soft. She disappeared inside it. The scent of him enveloped her, and her body made a sound she had never made before, a low, involuntary set that came from somewhere primal. He turned to the wolves behind him. She had almost forgotten they were there. 5 men and 2 women. All in the black and silver of the Northern Dominion, all very carefully not looking at her with anything but neutral expressions. "We return to the keep," Kael said. "She rides with me." The nervous-voiced man, a wiry redhead with an eye patch, cleared his throat. "Your Majesty, the Council will want to know." "The Council," Kael said, "will be told that I have found my mate. If they have opinions about the timing, they may write them on parchment, and I will use the parchment to start my hearth fire." A dark-haired woman at the back of the group failed to completely suppress a smile. The ride to the keep took 4 hours. Lyra spent them on the back of Kael's war beast, a living one, massive and silver-furred, its gait smooth despite its size. Kael sat behind her. His arms bracketed her body as he held the beast's rein harness. His chest was a wall against her back. Every time the beast shifted stride, Lyra was pressed against him, and heat surged through the contact points like electricity arcing between poles. She was filthy, and she smelled like death, and she was so hungry. Her vision kept tunneling at the edges, and some part of her brain was screaming that this was impossible, that mates did not happen to wolfless, packless, nameless girls who slept in record rooms and hid inside corpses. But the bond was there. She could feel it now. Not just his heartbeat, though that was constant. A low, steady drum she felt through his chest and into her spine. It was more than that. It was a thread, a tether, a line of light strung between her rib cage and his, and every time she tried to think about running it, pulled taut and hummed with a frequency that made her bones ache. Kael did not speak during the ride, but his thumb moved, back and forth across her upper arm, where his hand rested near her shoulder, a slow, rhythmic stroke. Soothing. She suspected he was not fully aware he was doing it. The Northern Dominion keep was not what she expected. The records had described it as a fortress, a citadel of grey stone and iron gates, and it was. But it was also clearly a home, in the way that a well-used kitchen is more home than a pristine parlour. The grey stone walls were softened by climbing ivy, even in winter. The iron gates were flanked by lanterns that burned with warm amber light. The courtyard was busy with people, actual people doing actual things. A woman hanging laundry, two children chasing a cat, an old man sharpening an axe on a whetstone with the focused serenity of a monk at prayer. Everyone stopped when the Alpha King rode in with a blood-covered woman in his coat. "She stays in the north wing," Kael told a broad-shouldered woman who appeared with the efficient speed of someone who had been managing crises for decades. The woman had graying hair pulled back in a braid, and hands that looked like they could knead bread dough and snap wrists with equal proficiency. She looked at Lyra. Lyra looked at the ground. "Bath first," the woman said. Her voice was brisk, but not unkind. She looked like she wanted to ask questions. She did not ask them. Then food. Then the physician. "She eats first," Kael said. "Before anything else, she eats." The woman, whose name was Maren, took Lyra to a room on the second floor of the north wing. It had a bed. A real bed, not a cot and not a floor, with sheets that smelled like lavender and a quilt thick enough to drown in. There was a fireplace already lit, crackling with birch logs that filled the room with a sweet, papery warmth. There was a window that looked out over the ashwood, the same forest Lyra had nearly died in, but from this vantage it looked like a painting, distant and harmless. Maren left and returned with a tray. Bread still warm from the oven, the crust crackling when Lyra broke it. Butter. A bowl of bone broth thick enough to coat a spoon, with flecks of rosemary and garlic floating on the surface. Sliced pears. A hard cheese with a nutty, sharp bite. Lyra ate too fast. Her stomach seized after the third mouthful, and she had to stop, pressing her fist against her abdomen, breathing through the cramp. Then she ate more, slowly. The broth warmed her from the inside out. The bread dissolved on her tongue. She ate until her body felt heavy and foreign with fullness. Then she cried. Not dramatically, not with sobs. Silently. The tears just came, and she sat on the edge of the enormous bed in the room with the fireplace and the lavender sheets, and she cried. Because she had not eaten a hot meal in 4 days, and because no one had ever put rosemary in broth for her before. Maren returned again. She did not comment on the tears. She drew a bath in a copper tub that had been set up in an alcove. The water steamed, She added something that smelled like eucalyptus and chamomile. I will leave you, Maren said. If you need help with... She paused, eyes traveling over Lyra's injuries. Anything. Pull the bell cord. Lyra sank into the water, and the heat found every wound she had been ignoring. The cut on her palm sang. The bruise on her forearm from the cellar ceiling throbbed and then eased. Her muscles, clenched for days in cold and fear, began to release, one by one, like fists slowly opening. She washed the blood from her skin. She washed the death smell from her hair. Underneath the grime, she was all sharp angles and visible ribs, but her skin was clear and her features, reflected in the water's surface, were fine-boned and even. She had not looked at herself in months. She barely recognized the face. When she stepped out of the bath, wrapped in a linen robe that Maren had left, she found Kael standing in the doorway. He had changed. The leather coat was gone. He wore a simple gray tunic that did nothing to diminish the scale of him. His hair was damp. He looked like he had washed up in haste, like the 4 hours between leaving her and now had been too long. His eyes tracked over her. Not the way men had looked at her before, the few times they had looked at her at all. Not appraising, not dismissive. Something else. Something that had hunger in it, yes, but also a kind of furious tenderness, as if she were something precious that had been left out in the rain. You are clean, he said. Yes, good. He swallowed. She watched his throat work. The bath suits you. She almost laughed. It came out as a choked exhale. I look like a skeleton in a robe. You look, he said, and then stopped. He gripped the doorframe. His knuckles whitened. You look like the reason I was put on this earth. She stepped back. Not from fear. From the intensity of it. From the way those words landed in her chest and detonated. You do not know me, she said. I know your heartbeat, he said. I have been hearing it for 3 days. I know it speeds up when you are afraid, and slows when you sleep, and that for 40 minutes on the first night it was so faint, I thought. He stopped again. His jaw flexed. I thought I had imagined you, that my wolf had finally driven me mad. The fire crackled. The eucalyptus-scented steam drifted between them. I have no wolf, Lyra said again, because it was the truest and most important thing about her, and he needed to understand it. I cannot shift. I cannot bond. I cannot be a Luna to your pack. I would be a liability. A weakness. My wolf, Kael said evenly. The beast that has terrorized my court and my commanders and my own mind for 11 years. The beast that once broke a challenger's spine during a territorial dispute. That wolf is currently curled on its belly inside my chest, purring, not growling, not pacing, purring, like a cub next to its mother. He took one step into the room. So do not tell me what you cannot be. Because whatever you are is the only thing in this world that quiets the monster in me. She should have argued. She should have run. She had been running, technically, for 3 days before this. Running from a pack that did not want her. From a world that told her she was empty. From the bone-deep conviction that she would die alone and unmourned, and that it would be fine because there was nothing in her worth mourning. Instead, she said, I am afraid. He nodded. I know. I have nothing. You have me. That is a terrifying offer from a man I met an hour ago. He considered this. Then, unexpectedly, the hard line of his mouth twitched. Not quite a smile. The ghost of one. Technically, he said, you have been sleeping inside my war beast for 3 days. I would say we are past formal introductions. She did laugh then, a real laugh, raw and surprised, and it hurt her throat because she had not laughed in so long that the muscles had forgotten how. He crossed the room. He took her hand. His palm was calloused and enormous and hot against her skin. He turned her hand over and looked at the cut across her lifeline. "Who did this?" he asked. "I did. Accidentally. Cutting into the beast to make a space to sleep." He ran his thumb along the edge of the wound. Gently. The tenderness was devastating, because it was so at odds with every other thing about him. "And the older scars," he said. "The ones on your wrists. On your back." She pulled her hand away. "Those are mine." The silence between them was thick with all the things she was not saying. He let it sit. He did not push. But his eyes burned, and she understood, with the clarity of someone who had spent a lifetime reading between lines, that when he found out who was responsible for those scars, something irreversible would happen. "I will not mark you tonight," he said. She blinked. The statement was so abrupt and so specifically not what she expected that her thoughts derailed entirely. "I can feel my wolf clawing to claim you. Every second you are near me and unmarked is..." He paused, searching for the word. "Excruciating. But you are injured and starved and terrified, and I will not be another thing that takes from you without asking." She stared at him. "When you are ready," he said. "If you are ready, you will tell me." He turned and walked to the door. He paused there. "The room is yours. No one enters without your permission. There is a lock on the inside, and Maren will bring meals 3 times a day. If you need me," he tapped the center of his chest, "you already know how to find me." He left. Lyra stood alone in the room with the fire and the steam and the lavender sheets and the sound of his heartbeat still echoing in the cage of her ribs. She locked the door. Then she crossed to the bed and pulled the quilt up to her chin and pressed her palm flat against her own chest, feeling the twin rhythms there, her own fluttering and frantic, and beneath it, steady as tides, steady as the turning of the earth, his. She slept better than she had ever slept in her life. The next 3 weeks were strange. Strange in the way that waking from a nightmare is strange. That disorienting adjustment period where you keep flinching at shadows that are not there. Maren brought meals. The meals were unreasonable. Roasted root vegetables glazed with honey and thyme. Venison stew with juniper berries and dark bread so fresh the crust steamed when she tore it. Poached eggs on beds of sautéed greens with a cream sauce that Lara ate with her fingers when she thought no one was watching. Her body, so long accustomed to want, responded with bewildered gratitude. Weight returned to her frame. The sharp edges softened. Color came back to her face. Kael visited every evening. He did not enter the room. He stood in the doorway, or sometimes sat on the floor in the hallway with his back against the wall, and they talked through the open door like neighbors who happened to share a wall. He told her about the Northern Dominion. Not the political structure, not the military might, but the small things. The way the aurora painted the sky green and violet over the keep in deep winter. The old cook, who swore he could predict snowfall by the ache in his left knee and was right 80% of the time. The feral cats that had colonized the southern tower, and that Kyle secretly fed table scraps, though he denied it to his council. She told him about the records, about the 40 years of births and deaths and exiles catalogued in her careful hand, about the way she had found stories hidden in the margins, tiny notes left by previous record keepers, a pressed wildflower between the pages of 1847, a sketch of a wolf pup in the margin of a census entry, a single line reading, "I am so tired of counting the dead." He listened the way no one had ever listened to her. Not politely, not patiently. He listened the way you listen to music, with his whole body oriented toward the sound of her voice. On the eighth day, she left the room. The keep was enormous and alive. Wolves moved through corridors with purpose, nodding to her with expressions that ranged from curious to carefully neutral. Nobody was hostile. She understood after the first few interactions that they were not friendly because they liked her. They were friendly because their alpha had found his mate, and in the hierarchy of wolf priorities, making the alpha's mate feel unwelcome was roughly equivalent to setting yourself on fire. She found the library on the third floor. It was magnificent. Floor-to-ceiling shelves of oak, heavy with books and scrolls and hand-bound journals. The smell hit her like a physical blow. Old paper and leather and dust and the faint ghost of lamp oil. She stood in the doorway, and her hands trembled, and she did not know why, until she realized it was joy. She was trembling with joy. She began spending her days there. Maren brought her lunch in the library and found her cross-legged on the floor, surrounded by open books, and for the first time since arriving, Maren smiled. "She reminds me of his mother," Maren told the cook that evening. The cook raised an eyebrow. She ate 4 bread rolls at lunch and did not notice. Maren continued. She was reading a treatise on war beast lineages, and she ate 4 bread rolls without looking up. His mother used to do that. Read and eat without noticing. Kael gets his stubbornness from his father, but his appetite for knowledge was hers. The cook said nothing, which was his way of agreeing. On the 12th day, Lyra found the treatise on war beast bonding. She was reading it because the memory of that heartbeat still haunted her. The war beast in the forest, the one that should have been dead, but was not. The heartbeat she had heard for 3 days. The one that Kael said he felt, too. "War beasts of the Northern Dominion," the text read, "are bonded to their riders through the bloodline of the Alpha. When a rider falls, the beast dies. When the beast falls, the rider dies. The bond is absolute and severed only by death. However, in rare cases documented primarily in the pre-unification era, a war beast bonded not to its rider, but to the rider's bloodline, through the Alpha line may persist in a state of suspended death if a living member of that bloodline is in sufficient proximity. The beast's heartbeat will slow to near cessation, but will not fully stop. It waits. It holds. It keeps the body warm." Lyra read the passage 3 times. She found Kael in his study. He was standing at a table covered in maps, the silver rune pins marking troop positions, 2 commanders flanking him. He looked up when she entered, and something in his face shifted the way it always did when he saw her, the stone cracking, the furnace eyes warming. The commanders, well trained, excused themselves. "The war beast," Lyra said, "the one I was inside. Its rider was dead." "Yes, but it was still alive." "Not alive. Suspended, because someone with the Alpha bloodline was nearby." Kael set down the map pin he had been holding. "Yes," he said. "You told me you could feel its heartbeat from across the forest, that your wolf responded." "Yes." "That is because the beast was bonded to the Alpha line, your line. It was waiting for someone of your blood to approach." Kael was quiet for a long time. Outside, wind pushed against the study windows, and the lanterns flickered. "That is what I thought initially," he said. Then he walked around the table. He stopped in front of her. He was so close, she had to tilt her head back to look at him. "But Lyra, the beast was not responding to me. I sent 3 scouts past its location before I rode out myself. None of them reported a heartbeat. It was only when I drew close enough to feel you. He paused. The heartbeat started when you crawled inside. She shook her head. That does not make sense. It makes perfect sense, he said. If you carry alpha blood, the words fell into her like stones into deep water. Sinking. Sending ripples. I am an Omega, she said. Wolf Baron. My mother was a kitchen worker. My father was nobody. Your mother, Kael said carefully. What was her name before she joined the Ashen Moor Pack? Elara. Elara. Lyra stopped. She did not know her mother's maiden name. It had not been in the records. She had looked. She had looked dozens of times over the years, and the entry for her mother's induction into the pack was the only one in 40 years that had a detail missing. No family name. No pack of origin. Just Elara joined Ashenmoor, year of registration. The entry was incomplete, Lyra whispered. Because someone removed the information, Kael said. I have had my archivists working since you arrived. Your mother's name was Elara Vane. She was the youngest daughter of the Silvermere Alpha Line, which was believed to have been entirely destroyed during the Crimson Purge 28 years ago. Lyra's legs went weak. She reached for the table. Kael caught her instead, his hand at her elbow, steadying. The Silvermere Alpha Line, he continued, was not merely an Alpha Line. They were direwolf kin, the oldest bloodline in the continental packs. Their wolves were not ordinary wolves. They did not surface at puberty like normal shifters. They emerged in response to extreme circumstances, bonded trauma, mortal danger. He looked at her. Or a mate bond so powerful it overrides whatever was suppressing them. I do not have a wolf, Lyra said. But her voice wavered because something inside her was stirring. Not words, not thoughts. Something lower. Something that lived in the animal part of her brain, in the space between instinct and identity. A presence she had always felt but dismissed as imagination. A warmth she had assumed was just her body's failed attempt to generate the wolf that never came. You do, Kael said. She has been sleeping, waiting. The way the war beast waited, holding, keeping warm. The room was very quiet. The maps rustled in the draft. Kael's hand was still on her elbow, and through the contact she could feel his heartbeat, steady and sure, and underneath it, his wolf, not purring now but alert, ears forward, watching. Something inside Lyra opened its eyes. It was not dramatic. It was not a flood, or an explosion, or a breaking dam. It was more like a door opening in a room she had always known was there, but had never been able to find the handle for. A warmth poured through her, not from Kael, not from outside, but from within, from a deep buried place at the base of her spine, where something enormous and patient and very, very old had been curled in the dark, waiting for exactly this. Her eyes changed. She felt it happen. The world shifted spectrum, colors deepening, edges sharpening, the smell of the room exploding into layers. She could smell the ink on the maps and the pine sap in the wood of the table and the lantern oil and the cold draft from the window and beneath all of it. Him. Kael. His scent unwound like a skein of silk, each thread distinct. The smoke and the pine and the cinnamon, and underneath it all, the mate scent, the one that was hers alone to detect, the one that smelled like home. Lyra, Kael breathed. She looked at her hands. Her nails were lengthening, curving, darkening. Not full shift. Not yet. But the wolf was there, pressing against the inside of her skin, stretching, testing. Oh, Lyra said. There you are, Kael said, and he was not talking to Lyra. The wolf receded, slowly, gently, like a tide pulling back. Lyra's nails returned to normal. Her vision settled, but the presence remained, curled warm and alert behind her breastbone. And for the first time in 23 years, the hollow space inside her was full. She looked at Kael. He was watching her with an expression she had never seen on anyone's face before, certainly not directed at her. It was awe. You have Silvermere eyes, he said softly. When your wolf surfaces. Silver. Like moonlight on water. I need to sit down, Lyra said. He guided her to a chair. She sat. He crouched beside her, one hand on her knee, and the touch did not feel proprietary or possessive. It felt like an anchor, like a tether to the world that was suddenly shifting under her feet. The Silvermere line, she said. Is that why? Is that why the Ashenmoor pack? She could not finish the sentence. But the shape of it was forming, terrible and clear. If her mother had been Silvermere, if the pack had known. The Ashenmoor pack was paid, Kael said. His voice was very even, very controlled. The control of a man holding something dangerous on a short leash. They were paid to take in the last Silvermere survivor and ensure she disappeared. Her child, you, was supposed to be declared Wolf Baron and kept invisible. Powerless. The pack elders who made the arrangement are mostly dead. But not all of them. Breeder, Lyra whispered. Breeder, Kael confirmed. The old woman with tobacco-stained teeth, who had declared Lyra hollow as a child, who had looked at her with lifelong contempt that Lyra now understood was not contempt at all. It was vigilance. The careful, maintained hostility of a guard, keeping a prisoner too broken to ever test the bars. Something inside Lyra shifted. Not the wolf. Something harder. Something that had teeth of its own. I want to know, she said. All of it. Every arrangement, every payment, every name. Kael's eyes glinted. My archivists are thorough, he said. You will have everything. But the revelations were interrupted. Because 3 days later, the Ashenmoor pack came to the Northern Dominion's gates. Not to attack. Even the most deluded pack would not attack the Northern Dominion's keep directly. They came under a flag of parley, and there were only 4 of them. Breeder, 2 of the surviving pack warriors, and Senna. Lyra watched from the library window as they were escorted into the courtyard. The war beasts flanking the gate shifted restlessly. Breeder walked with her arm in a sling, and her chin lifted in the particular defiance of someone who knows they are outmatched, but refuses to show it. Kael met them in the great hall. Lyra was not invited. She went anyway. The great hall was built from the same grey stone as the rest of the keep, but the ceiling soared 3 stories high, supported by columns carved with wolf figures so detailed they seemed to move in the firelight. A hearth, the size of a small room, dominated the far wall, the fire burning steady and hot. Kael sat in a chair that was not quite a throne, made of dark oak with iron fittings, positioned on a raised stone platform that added exactly no height he needed, but made a point about hierarchy. He did not look like the man who sat on her hallway floor telling her about feral cats. He looked like the Alpha King of the Northern Dominion. His face was stone. His golden eyes were flat. The battle scar across his face seemed to deepen in the firelight. Lyra stood in the shadows near a side column. Maren was beside her, hands clasped, expression unreadable. Breeder spoke first. We have come to retrieve our pack member, Breeder said. The girl called Lyra is property of the Ashenmoor pack. She was born under our care and is registered in our records. Lyra watched Kael's hand close on the arm of his chair. The wood creaked. Property, he repeated. She is Wolf Baron, Breeder continued. Useless in any martial capacity. We want her returned. Why? Kael asked. Breeder hesitated. It was brief, barely perceptible, but Lyra, who had spent a lifetime reading silences, caught it. Breeder was afraid. Not of Kael, though that fear was certainly present. Afraid of what would happen if Lyra stayed. If Lyra discovered who she was. If the truth about the Silvermere arrangement surfaced. She belongs with us, Breeder said. It was weak, and everyone in the room knew it. Kael leaned forward. The movement was small, but the entire room contracted around it. Lyra is my fated mate, he said. His voice carried the particular resonance of an alpha command, the kind that pressed against the base of the skull and made lesser wolves bare their throats. She bears the Silvermere bloodline, which you and your predecessors were paid to suppress and conceal. He paused. She is not your property. She is my queen. Breeder's face went white. Not dramatically white. Not soap opera white. The color drained slowly, starting at the lips and spreading outward, the way a wound pales before the blood comes. That is a lie, Breeder said. But the words had no backbone. Shall I present the payment records? Kael said. 700 gold marks per year, drawn from an account maintained by the Council of Elders under the authority of the late Lord Harlan, who orchestrated the Crimson Purge. I have the ledgers. Your signature is on 4 of the pages. A pause. Your handwriting is quite distinctive, Breeder. You dot your I's with small circles. Lyra looked at Breeder. She had spent her childhood terrified of this woman. Had spent years absorbing her cruelty and believing it was deserved. And now, seeing Breeder diminished and exposed in the firelight of a hall she had no right to stand in, Lyra expected to feel satisfaction. She did not. What she felt was something much more complicated. Because she was watching Breeder's hands, and Breeder's hands were shaking, and there was something in the old woman's eyes that was not just fear of being caught. There was exhaustion, the bone-deep exhaustion of carrying a secret for 23 years. And beneath the exhaustion, just briefly, so briefly that Lyra almost missed it, there was something that looked terrible and familiar. Guilt. Breeder had hated Lyra. That was true. But she had also fed Lyra, clothed Lyra, kept Lyra alive. Could have let the pack kill the child. Could have smothered the problem in its cradle and claimed crib death. But she had not. She had kept Lyra hollow and invisible, but alive, and in the calculus of cruelty versus murder. There was a margin that might, in a certain dim light, resemble mercy. I did what I was paid to do, Breeder said. Her voice was quieter now, the defiance draining out of her like water from a cracked cup. But the child lived. I could have. She stopped. The hall was silent except for the fire. I know, Lyra said. She stepped out of the shadows. Every eye in the room turned to her. She was dressed in clothing that Maren had provided, simple but clean, and her hair was combed and her face was clear, and she stood straight for the first time in her memory, because there was a wolf behind her sternum now, and that wolf did not cower. I know you could have. You did not. That is not forgiveness, but it is acknowledgement. Breeder stared at her. Something moved in the old woman's face, tectonic, slow, the shifting of deep structures that had held position for decades. You look like her, Breeder said, like a Lyra, when she first came to us, before. Before you broke her, Lyra said. Breda flinched. It was the first genuine human reaction Lyra had ever seen from her. Kale stood. "Breda of Ashen Moor," he said. "For the crime of conspiring to suppress a royal bloodline, for the imprisonment and abuse of a Silvermere heir, and for complicity in the Crimson Purge, you will be remanded to the Northern Dominion's justice. Your lands are forfeit. Your pack designation is dissolved." The two warriors flanking Breda shifted, but they were surrounded by Kael's guard, and they knew it. Then Kael looked at Senna. Senna had not spoken. She stood behind Breda with her arms crossed over her stomach, and her face was a wreck. She had been crying before she arrived. Her eyes were swollen, and her lips were chapped, and she was thinner than Lyra remembered. "You," Kael said. "Senna, was it?" "You told my mate to leave," Senna nodded. She did not try to defend herself. "My mate was injured, starving, and had just survived a raid that killed most of your pack," Kael continued. "And you told her to go." Senna looked at Lyra. The look held something Breeders never had. Not guilt as a brief fracture. Full acknowledgement. The weight of knowing exactly what she had done and feeling every ounce of it. "I did," Senna said. Her voice was steady, though her hands were not. "I was holding my mate's blood on my hands, and I looked at her, and I could not. I needed someone to blame, and she was." She stopped. "She was always the one we blamed. For everything. And I am sorry." The apology hung in the air, simple and bare and insufficient. Senna knew it was insufficient. She offered it anyway. Lyra said nothing for a long time. Then she turned to Kael. "Senna is not Breda," Lyra said. "She was cruel in grief. That is different from cruel by design." Kael's jaw tightened. He clearly disagreed. His wolf clearly disagreed. But he looked at Lyra, and she looked at him, and the mate bond between them carried something that words could not. A current of trust, of deference. Not the deference of weakness, but the deference of partnership. "Your mercy," he said, "not mine." Senna was released. She left the keep that evening, alone, walking south. Lyra watched her go from the library window. Senna did not look back. Breda was taken to the lower cells. "Not dungeons," Marin explained. "Proper cells, with beds and meals. The Alpha King does not keep dungeons. He says they remind him of his father." The days after the Ashenmoor confrontation were quiet. Lyra read. She studied the War Beast treatises, and the Silvermere genealogies, and the history of the Crimson Purge. She ate meals with Kael in his study, the two of them on opposite sides of his map table, sharing bread and cheese and silence that had become comfortable. Her wolf surfaced more frequently now. Not full shifts. Not yet. But moments. A flash of silver in her eyes when Kael said something that made her laugh. A rumble in her chest when she was deep in thought. A surge of warmth when she was cold. The wolf was testing, growing, becoming, and beneath it all, the bond deepened. Not just the heartbeat, not just the scent. She could feel his emotions now, dimly, like hearing music through a wall. His anger came through as heat, his humor as a quick, bright pulse, his desire as a slow, dense pressure that made her knees weak. He was patient. Brutally patient. He never entered her room. He never touched her beyond the occasional hand on her elbow or the press of his fingers against her back as they walked. She could feel the effort of his restraint, could feel his wolf straining against the leash of his will, and the fact that he held it despite everything was more convincing than any declaration. It was Lyra who broke first. 3 weeks and 4 days after she had been pulled from the carcass of a war beast, Lyra walked to Kael's chambers at midnight. She was barefoot. The stone floor was cold under her feet. She wore the linen sleeping shift Maren had provided, and nothing else. Her hair, clean and growing improperly now, fell past her shoulders. The silver ring on her finger caught the moonlight from the corridor windows. She knocked. He opened the door instantly. He had not been sleeping. His eyes were molten gold in the low light, and his chest was bare and scarred, and his hair was disheveled, and he looked at her as if she were the answer to a question he had been asking his whole life. "I am ready," she said. He reached for her, then stopped, his hand hovering. "Say it again," he said. "I am ready. I want the bond. I want the mark. I want..." She faltered, not from uncertainty, but from the magnitude of what she was saying. "You. I want you." He pulled her into the room. The door closed. What happened next was not gentle, but it was careful. There is a difference. Gentle implies restraint. Careful implies awareness. He was aware of every sound she made, every shift of her body, every inhale. His hands were enormous and calloused, and they traced the scars on her back with a touch so precise it was almost clinical, as if he were memorizing them, cataloguing them, filing them away for later reckoning. The bond flared when he kissed her. Not her lips, not first. Her collarbone, where the skin was thin and the pulse visible, and the contact sent a wave through the bond that made them both gasp. She felt his heartbeat double and synchronize with hers. She felt his wolf surge forward, not to dominate, but to press against the thin membrane between his soul and hers, and on the other side, her wolf rose to meet it. They lay together on his bed, which smelled like him, pine and smoke and cinnamon, and the room was dark except for the fire and the moonlight, and in that darkness she was not Wolf Baron, and he was not the Alpha King. They were just two creatures who had been alone for a very long time, and were no longer. When he marked her, it was at the juncture of her neck and shoulder. She felt his canines elongate and press and then break the skin, and the pain was bright and brief and instantly overwhelmed by something else, a connection so vast and intimate it erased every boundary between them. She could feel his childhood. Brief flashes, a mother with silver eyes reading to him, a father's heavy hand, brothers wrestling in mud, a crown placed on his head at 17 when he was too young and too angry and too alone. And he could feel hers, the record room, the cold, the cut hair, the counting, the endless, relentless counting, as if by keeping track of every detail she could impose order on a world that offered her none. He pressed his forehead to hers. His breath came in ragged intervals. His eyes were wet, and she realized with a shock like cold water that the Alpha King of the Northern Dominion was crying. "I would have found you," he said. His voice was wrecked. "If you had died in that forest, if the beast had not kept you warm, I would have torn every tree from the ground between here and Ashenmoor. I would have." "I know," she said. She touched his face, the scar under her fingers, the wet tracks on his cheeks. "But I did not die. I am here." The bond settled between them like a bridge bearing weight for the first time. Solid, certain, permanent. But permanence, Lyra was learning, does not mean peace. The Council of Elders arrived 6 days after the marking. They came in a procession of black carriages that wound up the mountain road like a funeral, and their faces when they disembarked were precisely the faces of people who have received news they did not want. There were 7 of them. Ancient wolves, all of them. Their power diminished by age, but their political influence still sharp enough to cut. They filed into the great hall and arranged themselves in a semicircle, and they looked at Lyra with the particular scrutiny of people who are assessing a threat. Kael stood beside her. His hand was on the small of her back. The touch was light, but the message was clear. "The Silvermere line is extinct," the eldest counselor said. A woman named Sarah, tall and gaunt with white hair, and a voice like dry leaves. She was declared extinct by this very council 23 years ago. You cannot resurrect a bloodline by mating a wolfless girl and claiming she carries royal blood. "She is not wolfless," Kael said. "She has never shifted," Sarah countered. Lyra stepped forward. Kael's hand fell away from her back. He let it. "You are correct," Lyra said. She addressed Sarah directly. "I have never shifted. My wolf was suppressed, deliberately, from birth. The Ashenmoor Pack was paid by this council, or by members of this council, to ensure the last Silvermere heir remained powerless and invisible." A stir among the councillors. Sarah's expression did not change, but the councillor beside her, a heavy-set man named Uldric, shifted his weight and his eyes darted left, which was the tell of a man looking for exits. "These are serious accusations," Sarah said. "They are documented accusations," Lyra said. She had spent the last 6 days in the library, not just reading, but compiling. The record keeper in her, the meticulous cataloguer of details, had found its purpose. "I have the payment ledgers. I have the correspondence. I have the original order for the Crimson Purge, with 3 council signatures, 2 of which belong to members currently sitting in this hall." She looked at Uldric. Uldric looked at the floor. And she looked at Sarah. "The 3rd signature is yours," Lyra said. Sarah's composure held. She was old, and she was practiced, and she had survived longer than anyone in this room. But her hands, folded in her lap, pressed together until the knuckles blanched. "The Silvermere line was a threat," Sarah said. Her voice was measured. "Their wolves were unpredictable, uncontrollable. The direwolf strain made them volatile. The purge was a political necessity." "A political necessity," Kael said. His voice was quiet, dangerously quiet. Lyra felt the anger through the bond, not hot but cold, the deep cold of a man who has learned to channel fury into precision. "You killed 17 people, including children. You orphaned my mate. You paid a pack to break her spirit and keep her empty. And you call it necessity." "I call it what it was," Sarah said. "And I would do it again." The hall went silent. Not the silence of shock. The silence of a room recognizing that a line has been crossed. Kael stood perfectly still. Lyra could feel his wolf pressing, demanding, the leash of his control straining to its absolute limit. The scar on his face was livid in the firelight. His golden eyes were the eyes of something that hunted in darkness and never missed. Then Lyra did something no one expected. She shifted. It was not dramatic, the way the old stories described it. No explosion of light, no screaming transformation. It was like breathing. One breath she was Lyra, in her simple dress with her silver eyes and her careful hands, and the next breath she was the wolf. She was enormous, larger than a standard alpha wolf, larger than Kael's wolf form, larger than anything any of them had seen outside of war beasts. Her fur was silver white, the color of moonlight on snow, and her eyes in wolf form were pools of liquid silver that reflected the firelight like mirrors. She stood in the great hall, and the stone floor cracked under her weight, and every wolf in the room, every counselor, every Gilgal, felt it. The Alpha Command, not Kael's, hers. Rising from her like heat from a forge, ancient and overwhelming, the command of a bloodline that predated every pack in the Dominion. The counselors dropped, not by choice. Their wolves forced them. Sarah, who had not bowed to anyone in 40 years, went to her knees with a sound that was half gasp and half sob. Lyra shifted back. She was naked, which was the inconvenient reality of shifting, and Kael's coat was around her shoulders before the cold air touched her skin. He moved faster than she could track. She pulled the coat closed. She was breathing hard. Her wolf settled inside her, satisfied, not retreating this time, but coiling, staying, present. The Silvermere line, Dormt-to, Lyra said, is not extinct. The room was very quiet. Aldrich was the first to speak. He spoke from his knees, his voice thin and reedy with fear. What will you have of us? He asked. Kael looked at Lyra. The question was in his eyes, clear and absolute. Your call, she considered. The record keeper in her wanted precision. The wolf in her wanted blood. The woman who had slept in a records room for 20 years and eaten scraps and counted salt jars in cellars wanted neither. She wanted something simpler and more devastating than revenge. You will tell the truth, Lyra said, to every pack, to every territory. You will publish the records of the Crimson Purge. Every signature, every payment, every name. She paused. And then you will resign from this council. All of you who signed. The rest will stay and rebuild something that does not require the murder of children to maintain stability. Sarah looked up from her knees. Her white hair was disheveled. Her ancient eyes were hard. But behind the hardness, Lyra saw something that surprised her. Relief. Sarah had been carrying this for 23 years. The weight of it was in every line of her face, in the stoop of her shoulders, in the way she held her hands, so carefully still. And now it was over. The secret was out. The burden was someone else's. Your mother, Sarah said quietly, was the bravest wolf I ever knew. And I destroyed her, because I was afraid of what her bloodline meant for the power structure I had spent my life building. She paused. You have her eyes. I know, Lyra said. The council departed the next morning. The carriages wound back down the mountain road, and the keep settled into a different kind of quiet. The quiet of a place where something fundamental has shifted. Kael found Lyra in the library that afternoon. She was sitting in the window seat, a book open in her lap. But she was not reading. She was looking out at the ashwood. He sat beside her. The window seat was not designed for a man his size, and he had to angle his legs to fit, which looked ridiculous, and which he did without complaint. How do you feel? He asked. Large, she said. He raised an eyebrow. My wolf. She is. Lyra searched for words. Bigger than I expected. Bigger than the space I had made for her. It is like discovering you have an extra room in your house, and the room is the size of a cathedral. Kael was quiet for a moment. Then he said, My wolf would like to formally inform your wolf that he is besotted and slightly intimidated, and he would appreciate it if she did not stand on him. Lyra looked at him. He was looking at her with an expression that was entirely serious, despite the words. She felt the bond hum between them, warm and golden and impossibly strong. She closed the book. The coronation, she said. When? Whenever you are ready. I will never be ready, she said. So let us do it now. The coronation of Lunar Queen Lyra of the Northern Dominion was held 3 days later in the Great Hall, with the cracked floor still unrepaired, because Kael said it was a reminder of what Silvermere power looked like, and he wanted his court to see it every day. Maran dressed her. Not in white, which Lyra refused, and not in black, which was the Dominion's color, in silver, a dress that caught the light and threw it back in fractured patterns across the stone walls. Her hair was loose. Her mother's ring was on her finger. The mark on her neck, where Kael's teeth had broken the skin, was visible and deliberate. The pack gathered. Hundreds of them. Wolves and humans and children and the old man who sharpened axes, and the woman who hung laundry, and the two children who chased cats. They filled the hall and spilled into the corridors and out into the courtyard, where Maren had arranged for the ceremony to be broadcast through speaking stones. Kael placed the crown on her head himself. It was not the queen's crown that had sat in the treasury for decades. It was new. Silver, naturally. Shaped like wolf teeth interlocking, fierce and beautiful, and nothing like the delicate filigree she had seen in illustrations of other queens' coronets. "Lyra," he said. His voice carried through the hall. The Alpha Command was there, but it was not aimed at her. It was aimed at every living soul in earshot. "Silvermere, Luna of my pack, Queen of my dominion, my mate, my equal." He did not say mine. She noted that. He said my equal. The distinction was small and immense. She looked out at the crowd. She found Maren's face, the broad-shouldered woman's eyes bright with tears she was refusing to shed. She found the one-eyed scout who had been in the forest when she was pulled from the beast, grinning broadly. She found the dark-haired woman who had suppressed a smile when Kael threatened to burn the council's opinions, now openly beaming. She did not find Breda. Breda was in the lower cells, awaiting trial. She did not find Senna. Senna was somewhere south, carrying her grief toward whatever came next. Lyra turned back to Kael. He was watching her the way he always watched her. Like she was the most fascinating thing in a world he had largely grown bored with. Like she was a sentence in a language he had been trying to learn his whole life and had just now begun to understand. She took his hand. The crowd went quiet. The fire popped and crackled. Outside, wind moved through the ashwood and the trees made a sound like distant applause. She did not say anything. She did not need to. The bond between them was wide open, a golden river, and everything she felt poured through it, and he received it and sent it back, doubled. She squeezed his hand, he squeezed back, and somewhere deep in the ashwood, in a clearing where a massive beast lay in suspended death, a heartbeat that had been hovering between life and ending chose, finally, definitively, to beat again. The war beast's eyes opened. Silver. They were silver. It rose on legs that should not have held weight, and it shook the frost from its midnight pelt, and it lifted its great head toward the northern keep, and it howled. In the great hall, Lyra felt it. A resonance in her chest, a vibration in her bones. The call of something ancient, recognizing something returned. She closed her eyes. Her wolf surged behind her ribs, warm and vast and awake. Outside, snow began to fall. The first heavy flakes of deep winter settling on the stone courtyard, like a silence that had finally, after a very long time, found somewhere to land.